Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 107th episode of the Manor Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Michael, Flesh and Blood's great. I really like Flesh and Blood right now. I like the meta. I like Limited. I like all the formats. The game designers really know what they're doing right now. I just feel like it's just the best game currently that anyone could play. Don't you agree?
I think the game is very good. This is very, very reminiscent of what you started a podcast a little over a year ago, I think.
No, because Brian Gottlieb was on that one. Oh, but yeah. Brian Gottlieb's on this one. Oh, hey, Brian.
Wait, are you saying you don't start every podcast with like your affirmations of Flesh and Blood and how great it is? Because I think that's what you should do every single week, honestly.
Not every week. Not every week.
Just so, when I'm here.
Yeah, just when you're here. And, you know, I figured like I start off on a positive note since last time my trolling note fell a little flat, I felt like. So I thought I'd fluff you up this time.
Nice. I'm always here for a good fluffing. And now we have to scrap this entire podcast. We just got to start over. No way. No, you know what? Leave it in.
Keep it rolling.
Keep it rolling.
Okay. Well, I won't have you do introductions because everybody who listens to our podcast, I'm sure, knows who you are. And yeah, I figure we can just get into it. And I want to start at the highest high level that you can possibly start, which is basically, so over the past couple of years, we've in Flesh and Blood, we had what many people consider to be like a depowering, less talents, pulled back power level, a little bit flatter, more numbersy. And then with MST, we clearly had a ramp back up in power level, talents, and just kind of more splashy Flesh and Blood that kind of is more reminiscent of like the Monarch or Tales of Aria era. And that dichotomy is pretty jarring. And it felt like no matter what, people were unhappy at various times, because people are always going to be unhappy. But I guess from like a broader like philosophical perspective, is this kind of just levers that you and the team are just pulling back and forth, up and down, that we should get used to this kind of cycle, or is just like still trying to find your exactly sweet spot?
Yeah, I would say expect cycling. I don't know what I would say get used to this type of cycle. Certainly there can be arguments that we push too far on either side of the poles. You know, some sets were maybe too weak, some sets are too strong. I'm very receptive to those arguments. But I do think it's important that we flow through, maybe less so than power level. Power level is just kind of, I don't want to say it's an accident. It's clearly purposeful and directed, but it's never really the direct goal. Like, you're not shooting to be like, this hero is powerful, this hero is bad, this hero is powerful. Like, it's just not the way things work. You kind of put together their kits and their gameplay and you see what presents, and you know, you make sure that you're always working within acceptable ranges. If something is too weak, you try and bring it up. Something too strong, you try and break it down. And then you kind of hit that sweet spot where everyone enjoys the hero. But I do think in terms of play styles, you should expect cycling. And that means sometimes the game will be number focused. Sometimes it can be fatigue oriented. Sometimes we're going to be an aggro meta. All of these things should be within the range of possibilities. And I think it's because of the reason that you said, and I don't mean this in a snarky way, but just like somebody is always going to be unhappy. Like, that's just the reality of gameplay, is that we all want different things out of our gameplay. And, you know, despite the most, you could go to the most universally acclaimed meta we've ever had. I don't know what that is. Like, maybe it's heavy hitters. Maybe it's not. Like, you can certainly make cases for a few different meta games, but there is always somebody unhappy in those places. Like, unquestionably, there's somebody who just the playstyle doesn't work for them. And that just kind of speaks about how many different experiences Flesh and Blood, and I think like any good TCG can provide. You want to have something that is fresh, new, always cycling. Because we just did the same thing set after set after set. I know, like, sometimes you think you want that. You want the familiarity. You want it to be the same as that thing you really enjoyed in the past. But you would lose interest. Like, it is important that there's always fresh formats, fresh gameplay styles. And I think that is way more where our goals are pointed towards than saying, let's make the game powerful now. Let's make it not powerful right now.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess baked into that, though, is also the cycling between talents and non-talented sets. And I know there's been talk that they're kind of something that's supposed to be more special in the world of Wraith and that they shouldn't be in every set. But I guess if I take it a step back, I've always said that I feel like talents are a good stratification of game systems and engines, and where if something breaks in like Light Warrior, for example, you don't have to worry about that breaking Draconic Warrior, or you don't have to worry about that breaking just the base class Warrior in and of itself. And I guess I'm just worried that if we keep saying the base level of classes over and over and over again, even with like the differences between something like Starvo and Victor, that it's going to be hard to have that in base stratification as much as it would be just keep relying on talents.
So I guess if I'm hearing you correctly, you're just concerned about the ability to, for these base heroes to kind of provide those same compelling experiences.
So
I think that has way more to do with the heroes themselves than the actual talented or non-talented nature of the heroes. And again, I can point to something like KO. KO, just like a very base brute, obviously can compete with any talented hero, outshines Leviah for the most part. Like, it is entirely possible to, within the hero class or the base hero class, to provide those compelling experiences and to overshoot talents on power level. I agree with your assessment that throughout the history of Flesh and Blood, it's trended the other way. Talented heroes have been more powerful. Certainly, you look at the list of living legended heroes, it is entirely talented heroes. So there is a lot of evidence that like things point in that direction. Certainly, recency tells us as well, Mystic class comes out, those three heroes, all very powerful. I don't think it's as much a function of the talent themselves, though, as maybe our excitement to explore those talents and like to be able to offer these really unique cards that, because it's all about flavor, right? You're always trying to capture the flavor of the thing you're portraying via the card. And certainly the flavor of Guardian is going to have less options available to you as a designer than the flavor of, say, Light Guardian or Earth Guardian or any Guardian, because you just have an additional component to add into your flavor profile, an additional sort of way of engaging with the game where you could say, oh, that's not, you know, typical of the Guardian class. But once you have an Earth Guardian, yeah, it makes sense to have this effect. Something like, I guess, Crown of Seeds. Like, Crown of Seeds makes no sense in just the base Guardian class. But when you get to Earth and you have that kind of recycling theme, yeah, it makes sense. And then you get a really, really powerful card that we had to take out of Classic Constructed forever. And that had so much more to do with just like exploring what Earth was capable of than saying, oh, this is a talented Guardian's tool, so therefore it will be more powerful than the base Guardian's tool. And like I said, there are several examples of just like the non-talented thing keeping up with the talented thing. The most prevalent one I'd point to is KO right now. I think that's the one that, and it helps that that's a recent print as well, because it kind of shows like the way our understanding of design has evolved. Like, if you're pointing back to original Welcome to Wraith heroes and being like, oh, these heroes are underpowered in comparison to everything else, it's like, well, we've learned a lot in 5 years. Like, we know a lot more about how to make compelling heroes. So yeah, those heroes can be somewhat underwhelming sometimes against sort of newer additions, but I think that's part of their charm. And I think it's, again, good to have a mix of both. Like, you just want these heroes that stick around for a very long time, and you know, people can make their core identity around that hero, and they can be a Bravo player for going on 5 years now, and all the suffering that often comes along with that. Although some good times as well, right? Like, we all know Bravo has had moments in the metagame. So I think it's good to offer, again, just a different set of experiences that people can buy into if that's what they want to do.
Sure. And I guess buying into heroes, there's no better way to do that than in the Living Legend format. And I think Michael has some Living Legend thoughts he wants to address.
I am big on hearing Living Legend thoughts, because that's kind of my baby right now. I am very much in love with that format. So hopefully you are too, Michael. Otherwise, I'm going to walk off this podcast and not answer these questions.
I hope you don't walk off the podcast. I'm actually, I haven't played as much of it as I would like to, but Chicago is coming up at the end of the year, and it's Living Legend. That's kind of a big deal, Living Legend calling.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a huge deal. I think it shows that, you know, there is interest and demand. We always said we weren't going to force this down people's throats, right? Like, it had to be something that we were comfortable that the demand was accumulating. You know, tournament organizers were interested in it. Players were interested in it. It had to be real buy-in across the board. And we only pulled the trigger on Chicago once we were sure we had that buy-in. So I agree. I think it's a massive deal.
That makes a lot of sense. So how is managing the ban list for Living Legend worked? Or I guess it's a restricted list. It's not really the...
And what would it take for something to actually be banned, I guess? Is there ever a limit where something could actually be banned in Living Legend?
100%. Like, obviously, the goal is, for as long as possible, I would like you to be able to play with all of your cards in the Living Legend format. Like, that's the starting point. And so kind of, if you want to talk the holistic approach to the restricted list, it was, let's create a format where you just can do everything. Everything's allowed. Every hero's allowed. Every piece of equipment, every card. If we can do this, then we're offering something really special. And I'll be honest, when we set out to start exploring this format, we didn't know if we could do it. Like, it just may not have worked out. And the idea to go with this restricted list, obviously a bit of an homage to Magic the Gathering. You know, all of us come from a Magic background. I shouldn't say all of us. A vast majority of us come from a Magic the Gathering background at LSS. And Vintage was always the format which had the restricted lists. It had a restricted list and a ban list. And all those iconic cards, Black Lotuses, Moxes, Time Walks, Time Twisters, all were restricted cards from basically the moment this format existed. And it became such an iconic part of that format's identity. And yeah, we kind of wanted to have our own version of that while also just supporting this goal of letting a player's collection have long-term standing value. Like, you should feel good that you bought a cold foil Crown of Seats. Like, it really, really should be something you can keep and use for a very long time. And obviously that was not going to be the case in Classic Constructed. So it's very important to us to have this other avenue where you could do this stuff. And I think too, like, there's so much joy in collecting Flesh and Blood for so many people, myself included. I love having these beautiful showpieces for folks like you and Michael who occasionally win tournaments. You have these beautiful gold foils, which you would love to use. And I think there has to be a home for all of this stuff. It's critical. So that just drove us from the beginning to see how many cards we could get into this format and keep it safe. As far as where we fell on the restricted list, it was mostly, you know, we kicked off everything Wild West, play whatever you want. And obviously there was a significant issue in the format. We had an 8-star vote, top 8. You know, I wouldn't say that surprised us. Like, we knew star vote was just completely absurd, as he always has been. And so that gave us our first set of tasks, right? Like, let's manage this hero and then we'll see what happens from there. And it wasn't like we're going to do this first wave of restrictions and then we're done and we're not going to touch it again. It was more, we did the first wave of restrictions and it turned out it just mostly worked. Like, when everything is super powerful, nothing really feels out of bounds. And you see that diversity reflected in that Battle Hardened top 8 from Amsterdam, 8 different heroes represented in that top 8. I mean, I really couldn't have imagined that kind of representation. And I think there were like 2 or 3 more heavily played heroes just below the cut. Like, there was Lexi lurking just below the top 8. There was KO and Reinar, Berserk focus builds just right out of range. So it just seems like there's so many viable heroes in that format right now. And I'll be honest, like, goal 1, address Starvo. We did a bunch of testing around that, a bunch of exploration, tried to figure out what the best set of restrictions were. Maybe took one step too far with the restriction of Channel Lake Frigid, but ultimately came back from that point. And found we had a format that we were mostly happy to continue to explore. But the fact that it worked out as well as it did, it's honestly fortuitous. Like, I'm just very, very happy that things have broken this way. And the more I play Living Legend myself, the more I speak to folks playing Living Legend, it seems like it's in a really special place right now. So it's makes me really happy.
For sure. I think the surprise breakout for me recently has been Oldheim, where he's even been popping up, where there's like actually because of his specialization Endless Winter and how good just stuffing activated abilities can be on a lot of the
Ice React too, man. Yeah. Ice React is so critical in this format. It's really cool. Like, again, I don't know that I would have told you Oldheim's going to have a carved out role in this format. Certainly, I just thought like, yes, Starvo's the Guardian and that's cool and it makes sense. But to see Oldheim get some purchase as well. And, you know, now we're obviously coming up to Rosetta and I'm like, maybe Briar starts to look a little interesting. And that's another hero that we can add into the mix.
That's honestly why we haven't tested more, is because Rosetta's coming out. And we want to make sure that, you know, we're giving it the good full due diligence with like Oldheim, Starvo, Lexi, giving access to these new lightning or earth cards that like it could be a real game changer for those heroes specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I'll spoil it for you. The Aria heroes are going to get better. That is just, it's a pretty safe assumption.
More cards gets better. Shocking. Yep.
And, you know, we'll see what that means for Chicago. I think all these cards still leave, you know, plenty of options on the table. It could be these heroes get a little good again and we have to adjust again. But, like, that's all good. Like, we're committed to this format. We will keep adjusting. And I think we found something with the restricted list that really does work for the identity of this format. And it lets us make these changes without saying, oh, you purchased all this stuff. Well, too bad for you. All these cards are gone now and you can't play them. I also love just how affordable these decks are coming up as well. It is quite easy to just go ahead and put together a Living Legend deck for now. I don't know if that will last forever. I hope it lasts for a very long time. But I've spoken to so many folks who have been able to go ahead and pick up a deck for this skirmish season at a very low cost, and really happy to hear that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's kind of in stark contrast to the format that you compared it to, Magic's Vintage earlier.
Yes, yes, it is working differently right now. But that's why I say for now, because like there was a period that was true as well. Like you could go ahead and trade your Shivan Dragon for a dual land and come out ahead on that trade. So I don't know how long this stays in the same path, but it'll be interesting to see how this format evolves throughout Flesh and Blood's life. And it also just like is a very good representation of how we view this game. And I said this from the moment I started working with LSS, and it's one of the reasons why I came on board, was like the long-term vision was so present from the first conversations I was having with James. And I remember just like talking about something, I can't recall what it was, but we were just like, you know, riffing on some design idea. And he'd be like, oh, we'll do that 5 years from now when we do this. And I'm like, wait, we're already stashing things for 5 years. And yeah, we really were. And that vision continues to be present. And I think LL is a good representation of that.
Awesome. And then I think, Michael, you had another question lined up as far as like the actual nuts and bolts of the Living Legend system itself, right? Like the actual accumulation of points.
I had a note.
It's okay.
Oh, yeah. So you talked about last time we had you on, you talked about how the Living Legend was working and you wanted to revisit and see how it was doing in a year or 2 years. And you said that you guys would make changes to it as were needed. Well, changes have been made. How have you felt about the Living Legend rotation, basically?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. I think, and it might be a little slower than I would like if I was just like sort of dictating how things were going to change. Like, I'm sort of surprised Dash is still around, but our numbers of events are just so in flux, right? And that's why we adjust things all the time, is we're trying to get the perfect blend of points plus events equals output. And because those event numbers change all the time, and when we structure these things and when we kind of model these things, and we do a lot of modeling around, you know, expected legalities and when we expect certain heroes to go, and it's tough. It's really tough to nail down. We've done an okay job of it, but sometimes things surprise us. But when we're doing this modeling, it's always based upon certain assumptions about how many events we're going to have. And I don't think those assumptions have ever held true, because there's just a lot of demand for events. Like people want more stuff and we want to deliver it. So there's been some kind of weird circumstances. There's also was just a huge disbursement of points throughout particularly the heavy hitters season, where just every hero in the world was picking up tons of points, and it was so stratified in terms of point disbursement that, you know, you make some assumptions. You're like, okay, this hero is going to get 25% of the points and this hero is going to get 15 and this hero is going to get 15. But it was just like everyone got 8%. And that kind of left a bunch of heroes still present. So I think the roster of heroes is a little larger than we would typically expect for CC at this moment. But we'll continue to adjust. And I am overall satisfied with LL right now. It's doing its job.
Yeah, I think there's 31 heroes currently legal in Classic Constructed. Well, at least once Rosetta releases with the extra three that are coming out there. But you say that there's too many heroes legal in Classic Constructed, but I'm still of the mind that just like full League of Legends, it just 100 heroes legal in Classic Constructed. I'd love to see that world where it's just like out of nowhere. Because with the storyline that came out with like Uzuri from the last Pro Tour, right? Like, nobody was picking Uzuri to win that Pro Tour. Like, you could tell me that Uzuri won the Pro Tour. I'm still not going back in time and picking Uzuri to win the Pro Tour. Like, it's just not how it's happening. But when you get into more larger hero pools, you do get really cool storylines like that, where like things can just like come out of left field, and it kind of leaves these more options for players to be invested and find that one hero in that larger pool that they really identify with.
So I agree with this entirely. And frankly, we've had discussions of like, well, what happens if we just League of Legends it and make tons and tons of heroes? And there's something appealing about that for sure. The thing I really struggle with is that even now at this level of heroes, there's heroes that are suffering, just haven't gotten support. Like Arachne comes to mind immediately. Like, when was the last time, short of Course of Tendency, you saw a card that was like, oh yes, this is clearly related to Arachne's game plan, pointed hard at Arachne? That's not because we don't love Arachne and we don't want to eventually, you know, give something for Arachne to use. It's just, it's hard to serve every conceivable hero all the time. And where assassins are already in a very good space, it's hard to say specifically, well, we're going to use our assassin cards on serving Arachne when we've invested so much into building up these other assassins. So it does present some problems. And I could point to heroes like Betsy, Olympia. You know, these are some heroes that I think just are a little underserved right now. That's the downside of the expanding hero roster. And, you know, you can say, oh, that's fine. You're like, there's no real victim there. But a hero releases, and for whatever reason, that's the hero that just absolutely speaks to you, right? You're like, this is my class. This is my hero. I'm going all in. I'm an Olympia main. I'm only playing this hero. It may not be great now, but I know the help is coming, and Olympia is going to be my hero for the next 2 years until I speedrun it to Living Legend. And then nothing really comes that changes things right away. You know, we had Visit the Golden Anvil, of course. An interesting card, I think, but it didn't ultimately shift Olympia's status in the metagame all that much. And now these people who have committed to Olympia are like, well, what do I do with this hero? It's not really achieving a whole lot. And that's a question we'll have to answer over time. But I think there are some feel bets that come along with those kind of scenarios. So we have to do our best to keep a reasonable pool of heroes so we can be serving as many as possible at all times. Of course, some are always going to lag behind. That's just natural. But yeah, the broader the pool gets, the tougher that problem is.
Cool. Okay. So now I've had my peanut butter argument of talented heroes are better. And I've had my chocolate argument of a bunch of heroes, and I'm going to put them together. And
not jelly? You're just having a peanut butter and chocolate sandwich to kick off the day?
It's a Reese's
peanut butter and chocolate's pretty good.
Yeah, it's peanut butter. I'm it's a combo. Yeah, I like peanut butter chocolate. Okay. Peanut butter M&M's are my favorite.
I just feel like spot. When you're doing this analogy, typically you would go down the peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
No, it's like those, like, it's from the, you're old like me, Brian. Remember those commercials where it's like, oh, you got my peanut butter and my chocolate. Oh, you got my chocolate and the peanut butter. Those used to be the commercials.
Yep.
There you go. So let's imagine Arachne was a talented hero, like maybe some kind of like Earth Assassin, right? And we were just alluding to, well, Oldheim's not in the Rosetta pool. There's no Guardian, but there's Earth cards. So Oldheim's getting something from the set just by overlapping with a talent. And that way you can kind of serve those heroes where, with the rotating shifting of talents, where even then in a supplemental slot, you could just print an ice card. And then if you have the ice heroes, all get that boost from that. And then that kind of helps you spread out this, like, the stratification of heroes also works from like additional cards as well, where you can just kind of help boost the talents. And by boosting the talents, you boost the heroes as well.
Yep. I have no argument against that. I mean, that's exactly right. And it's one of the benefits you have when working with those talented classes. You know, in moments where like a talent is already very strong in the metagame, that could slow you down a little bit. Like,
sure.
You want to be a little bit more pointed in those moments. But yeah, it's one of the benefits that talented heroes absolutely have over the non-talented heroes. They can kind of get that broad support. And it's one of the reasons we use the talent system. It does give us access to those type of printing mechanisms. So no dispute.
Woohoo. I'm glad my Reese's peanut butter cup argument was successful. but I guess on the last thing we'll touch on then, as far as like the whole living legend thing, is like in class constructed, like replacing those heroes and those class combination, things like that in time. And obviously a little over a year ago, maybe a year almost to the, yeah, a little over a year ago, we had Dusk Till Dawn, where we got the long-awaited replacement to Shadow Rune Blade and Light Illusionist. And needless to say, people weren't super thrilled with them, and they didn't still feel like Chain, and they didn't feel like Prism. And I guess like that kind of makes its own complications then, right? Where you don't want to just keep giving people the same thing over and over and over and over again, but yep. You also want them to have familiar play patterns. And I see what you're doing with, especially with like Vincette, very carefully giving her access to like those, the shadow cards. But Prism just kind of being completely focused on like the figments and angels was something almost like completely out of left field, it felt like. But do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we talked a lot about Dusk Till Dawn in retrospect, things that maybe we didn't fully unpack, understand. I think the consequence of taking these alternate lanes was something we didn't really, I'm not going to say we didn't think it through. Like, we did. We purposely did something different. That was our goal. And, you know, maybe we... It's kind of the same thing as everything else, right? You have somebody on your shoulder saying, I hate Prism. This better not be the same as Prism, or I'm definitely going to quit the game. And then there's the other person on your shoulder being, if this isn't like old Prism, I'm definitely quitting the game. So it better be like old Prism. And maybe in this instance, we listened to the people who were angry at old Prism a little bit too much. And it's just about finding balance. You know, we haven't sort of done this thing again. We haven't had the opportunity to go ahead and refresh a hero quite in the same way. You know, there's some of that going on with Aurora kind of stepping in for Briar, but it's not a one-to-one comparison. Obviously, we're missing the Earth side of things. So, and I think the next time we go ahead and look to replace a missing hero, we'll have a lot more information, a lot of learnings. And that's not to say we're going to make a one-for-one carbon copy of the hero that's being re-added, but I think we'll consider that a little bit more, and serving the old fans of that hero a little bit more will probably be a little bit higher up on our priority list next go around, is my guess. And, you know, maybe when the time comes and we do that design, just something else speaks to us. Like, I just am not going to put limiters on us to say definitely we will approach it this way. But I am cognizant of some of the failings with Vincette and Prism, if you want to call them failings, like certainly some of the drawbacks, let's say that. And that will factor into the next time we do this type of thing.
Yeah. And now there's the Armory deck Bolton. So Bolton got a bunch of good new cards. So I can stop harping on that set being not everything Bolton was hoping to be as well. So
how many cards from that set go into your Bolton deck, Roger? I'm sure there are several.
I think there's,
You have to count Warband as well.
I think it was just the Bannerets for a long time.
Yeah.
But now I am playing the Beaming Bravados as well. I think right now I have 3 red Beaming Bravados and 6 Bannerets, so 9.
Okay. So what percentage is that? A little over 10%.
Yeah, that's fair.
Maybe it should have been 20%. It's not that bad. Like, there were real Bolton cards in the set.
There were.
Wasn't Spirit in that set too?
Yeah. Oh, 10. You're
oh,
right.
No.
Spirit. No. Spirit was in Dynasty.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah.
Ooh. I am not a Bolton expert.
Speaking of Dynasty, have you heard, did we talk about this, or have you heard this, where I love that Dynasty has been the blueprint for everything we've seen basically over the past 2 years? Was that intentional? Like, when you guys set out to make Dynasty, like you introduced the figments for Prism, right? With the, or the, or the transforming angels. Maybe it wasn't fully fleshed out figments, but it was definitely the transforming angel. Yep. You have the basis for the assassin class, even if it pivoted away from Arachne. I know the assassin class was still something that was like really hard to work out, and something that even up till the, like you being the person who really pushed the assassin class, I guess, into even existing to begin with, like that.
Well, I don't want to say that. Like there were assassins in the set. I just had a lot to do with the design of Arachne, and assassin was intended to be in the game going back to Arcane Rising. So it's not like I pushed assassin into existence. It's just assassin was always going to be in Dynasty. I worked a lot on what that assassin ended up being.
Sure. So yeah. And then there's the aim counters and rangers that was introduced, and that we saw a lot of that introduced, and then in outsiders. For brutes, there was the taking away from dice rolling. There wasn't as much dice rolling and more focusing on more sixes as well. There's a couple of just really powerful brute dynasty cards as well, if I'm remembering correctly. For mechanologists, there were the items, right? And there was the
nitromechanoid too.
Nitromechanoid, yeah, that was the big one. For ninjas, basically, that's basically directly one for one ported into a classic constructed set now for this point. So it just feels like there's so many elements of Dynasty in retrospect that have shown that it was like sort of a blueprint stepping ground for a lot of the themes and ideas, which I think is like really smart to do for a supplemental set.
Yeah. Just a brilliant designer, Roger. I don't know what to tell you.
I just was wondering if it was like that, was that intentional? Like when you sat down to make that set, were these a bunch of scattershot ideas that like you wanted to like
look launch? I was literally just a contractor at this point, right? And a huge portion of my work was very pointed towards the assassin class. I saw all these other cards, I gave my input on it, but I was not really involved for the most part in the design of them. Like maybe there's one or two other ones I could point throughout that I had a heavy hand in, but I can't even recall them off the top of my head. Did James have that vision? Maybe. I mean, like I said, I think his long-term planning is kind of unparalleled. I think what's probably more true was that you go and you do some design work for this set and you find things that really interest you and you go, whoa, this is a really cool concept. What happens when we build this out next time we come to these heroes? And I think that was a kind of a big trend with supplemental sets in general, because you couldn't really deliver the full experience, right? Like you just start dancing around these ideas and exploring them, and then they entice you a little bit and you go, let's pay off this archetype now. Let's make it something really interesting, really special. And I think it's probably a more natural progression than the idea of I'm going to secretly lay out the next 3 years of Flesh and Blood in this Dynasty set.
That's fair. I just know that there's a big
possible
sprinkling of Easter eggs from like the future set names and like flavor text and things like that. So yeah. I just don't know how deep the 4D chess LSS play sometimes goes, but maybe
it can be pretty deep. like a huge structural thing like that. Probably not. Like, I don't think it was that pointed, but like individual little things along the way. And like I said, just the ideas being cool and then informing future approaches. I think that's more of what goes on with Dynasty.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And then speaking of that, the last time you were on as well, you were just a contractor still. So you got to sidestep a lot of our questions by saying, I don't know, I'm just a contractor now.
But yeah, actually, I just changed my contract again. I'm back to a contractor. I think I get rehired next week after this podcast.
Oh, I'm lucky. Damn it. Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, Michael, did you have a next question on your list?
I do have another question. So this year has been a very good year to be a limited player. We've seen several sealed callings. We got three draftable sets. Is this kind of the plan going forward? Three draftable sets a year, more sealed callings?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have always been clear about our commitment to limited, how important we believe it is as part of Flesh and Blood, sometimes to the point of starting fights with people on Twitter about how devoted we are to limited formats.
I've never done that before, so yeah, I'll take your word for sure.
But yeah, this was always the vision. It was always the goal to get to this place for limited. And I think we just continue to learn a lot about limited over and over and over. And we continue to take some risks. We continue to, you know, throw out sacred cows and redefine things like deck sizes and you know, how many packs you're going to get for sealed, all of these things, I think cumulatively are putting us in such a better place for things like sealed call-ins. And I do want to be clear about the 8-pack thing. At some point, it's going to lead to a format that just like is super powered, super, super strong. I still think that's way more interesting than playing the underpowered flesh and blood of previous limited formats. We'll see what happens when we hit the absolute ceiling of that, because there are going to be some fast limited games at some point. I think that's inevitable. But, you know, now that we're thinking about this all the time, designing around it all the time, I'm really excited for what it offers to sealed players. I think the idea of traveling to a limited calling just feels so much better now. Like, it feels so much safer in a lot of ways and so much more exciting to play that day one of sealed. And I also think draft is delivering as well. I'm really proud of the work the team has done around draft to, you know, answer, I think, a lot of the concerns around early flesh and blood limited, you know, the prevalence of fatigue, things like staying open for longer periods of time. I think Part the Misfail showed the capability of all of that. And I have to say, I no longer like call things the best. I don't ever want to do that again, because what is going to be the best means so many different things to so many people. I will say that the drafting process for Rosetta, and that's like, you know, sitting around the table, picking your cards, it's my all-time favorite drafting process we've ever had in Flesh and Blood. And a lot of that is based upon the structure of this set. And if you follow Juha Saarnalampi, who does like his really, really cool YouTube series, looks really closely at limited formats and just put out a video about the shape of this format, calling it out as a unique shape. And I love to see that, because we do think of these things in terms of shapes. Like, when we were doing these brainstormings, we were literally drawing shapes on the blackboard and trying to find these cool overlaps. And this particular shape of this limited format, I think it's my favorite so far. I think it just lets you do the open thing. And I'm sure you can like put together how that works, right? You have these two kind of parallel lanes, and you can be an all Earth deck, or you can be an all Runeblade deck, and then figure out which of those two paths you're going down as the draft progresses. And it's really, really, really satisfying to go through the draft process. So yeah, we just keep exploring different things like that. And I do think limited is the best it's ever been so far. And I would like to keep continuing down that path.
Yeah, I definitely agree that the drafting is something that's cream of the crop in MST. Like, it was really fun. Especially with the dynamics for the cloaked equipment, as I'm sure you're aware at that point. Like, I really like that set of equipment and those decisions. It's just, I really can't stress. I think I even messaged you after just playing like a couple of games of the 30 card limit. I was like, please keep the 30 card limit. I love the 30 card limit for limited so much. I think it's, so many games, when I think of like back in previous limited formats, where I think about like heavy hitters drafts, where I think like, oh man, I need this yellow unplayable card just because I need to be able to potentially block with it at some point. Or like, it's like taking these cards that I wasn't happy, but they just were a card that I could put in my deck, mattered a lot in pick orders and like at the end of packs, and not having that feeling anymore at the end of packs and being like, okay, well now I could actually look for like a small marginal upgrade in like certain things, or like potentially a sideboard card if I'd want to take out a blue against a user or something like that. Like, those end of draft decisions mattering is so rewarding, and I really appreciate that now.
I agree entirely. It was one of those things where as soon as we started playing with it, and actually, you know, we developed Part the Misfail with this in mind, and then like we finished Part the Misfail and we're like, should we just apply this to heavy hitters? Like, we didn't develop heavy hitters with this in mind, but it was very close to just being like, yeah, we probably should, because it felt that good. Ultimately, we were happy with the heavy hitters format in general. And we're like, let's not, you know, stomp around too much with something that is an unknown. But I think we probably could have done it, and it probably would have made heavy hitters even better. And I think back to Bright Lights development, and Bright Lights developing that draft set was so hard. It was I've never been I probably stressed. I think stressed is the right word I've never been as stressed at my job as I was developing Bright Lights Limited, because we go in with the goal of making this defensive hero, Tekle Vaasan, right? And that's the goal. He's supposed to defend a bunch, supposed to block you out. The problem is, as soon as he's good at that, the gameplay against him is kind of uninteresting, where he just lays down his hand every turn. If he doesn't do that, what's he doing? And we spent all this time, and I honestly still believe in the end, we got to a place with Bright Lights where if you put in your like 40 or 50 drafts, it was good. Like, you could figure out all these lanes. You could come over the top of Tekle Vaasan. Tekle Vaasan was probably actually the worst hero once you had put in that much time into the format. I think both Dash and Max were better. But you had to put in those 50 games until you got there, 50 drafts. And that was a huge, huge ask of our player base. And I think back to, what if we had just been able to develop that set with these limiters in place? It would have been totally different. And I don't know that if you like just go back and install those limiters, it actually makes things better, because there's a lot of issues where, like, you know, Max and Dash are actually sometimes asking for higher card counts. And it's so weird with fatigue, right? Like,
and especially in Mechanologist as well. Like,
right, with boost present in the set. Like, but regardless, I still wish we would have been able to explore under those limitations and seen what we would have been able to come up with in that case. And it's possible, you know, we could have done a little bit better job of making the answers to Tekle Vaasan a little bit more face up while still giving giving that hero a good identity, the cool like mech suit identity.
I know Michael's a big defender of Bright Lights, for what it's worth.
I did put in the 40 drafts or so I had some I had worlds to get ready for. So I put in the drafts, and the end of the format, I did like it quite a bit.
Yeah, I think it's redeemable. Like, I don't, you know, I do sometimes like talk bad about Bright Lights. It's not because I think it is just a poorly developed product or one that like doesn't have a good limited format. It's just so hard to access the depth and the excitement in Bright Lights. Like, as a casual player, it just was never going to appeal to that portion of the market. And that's what I feel like I really did a poor job of in my work on developing that set. I wasn't thinking enough about that kind of like 4 or 5 draft experience and just how tough it was going to be for a new player. And even like the intro experience as a seasoned player, right? Like, even I'm sure you guys, you play your first 10, 20 drafts and you're like, I was speaking to
you. I only very got the 10, good, 20 drafts. So.
Yeah. I think a lot of people dropped out after 10, 20 drafts, but I was speaking to like very good players who, you know, were 10 drafts in and they were like, I'd rather be the 8th Tekle Vaasan in this draft than anything else. And like, that's ridiculous and wrong.
But like, they felt, yeah.
I kind of understand where you were coming from. Like, I understand how you got to that point. And the fact that we didn't do a good job making the failure of that statement clear, that's on us 100%. So
that's fair. We haven't gone back and done that, but it's something I've been talking about doing, is just sitting down. I have all the boxes of all the previous sets behind me that we can just sit down and play like some 30 card deck Welcome to Wraith. I don't think Arcane Rising gets fixed at all, because I think that set, just from a limited perspective, is its own can of worms.
I'm not sure. I've actually been very interested with Arcane Rising specifically to go back and explore. I haven't done so yet. I think maybe more interesting is like 8-pack sealed 30 card limit, but then like you've also upped your chances of just finding the right Dash item as well.
That's what I was about to say. Like, yeah. People complain about Mirror Guy. I don't know if you've ever played against any of like the Induction Chamber in Arcane Rising. It's just it's over. It's just like,
you definitely better than Mirror Guy.
Yeah, 100% better than Mirror Guy. Like, there's actually nothing you can do at that point. But yeah, I think Monarch is the one that I'd be the most interested in revisiting for 30 card limits, especially with the new legendary rule, because that way, if somehow you open the double legendary shadow pool or whatever, you could actually like do the thing, which would be kind of cool, fun, and interesting. But that's in the past. But talking about the present a little bit more, what do you think? Like, I know you've gone on a couple other podcasts, and I don't want to rehash everything that you've talked on there. But as far as the current state of Zen in particular, I think on Fresh and Buzz you said that Traverse shouldn't block for two, maybe blocking for one or something like that. But I think the main problem that people have, or a lot of the criticisms that I've seen, have been that it feels really bad to be attacking your opponent and have them get like a benefit, that like it feels like the right line at some points in a game is to just like not attack them so they can't go and search off their transcend. So is that like an effect that you're going to be more wary of? Because on the other hand, at the same time, there's the Bolton deck that has the charge on defense, which I think is a good effect that I obviously love and I think is really fun and like does a lot of really cool and interesting things. But is it just like the dichotomy of putting those reward for blocking equipment, I guess, how do we think about balancing that going forward?
I'm honestly not sure yet. Like I just need more time to think about it and unpack, because I'm not convinced that the complaint is actually hard rooted in that play pattern. I think it's rooted way more in just what Zen does after that play pattern. Like if the output was like 10 points lower, then it'd just be like an accepted part of Zen's kit. The fact that it is so massive and so sky high, I think that's when it really starts to feel bad. And I think the decision, you know, to potentially not attack in some spots is interesting. Like that's, to me, the sign of a really, really deep game where you're often incentivized to act in sort of unintended or suboptimal fashion in order to prevent your opponent from doing something they want to do. That's an interesting strategic wrinkle to me. I understand why people don't like the way it presents in Zen. Like I think that is way more fair. Is it just like a failed concept to be able to turn defense into offense? My instinct is no. Like I think that is a redeemable play pattern. But I just want to explore a little bit more. Like I don't want to commit to either this is acceptable or this is bad. I understand where the complaints are coming from, but I am not entirely convinced it's actually about just the essence of the play pattern.
Yeah, so I think it might be like the power level of Zen's turns after that, because we've had Crown of Providence for a long time, and like sometimes you attack your opponent, they use their Crown of Providence, they filter their hand into a better hand, and that's like not something that we've gotten the same complaints about, you know, or the same complaints have come out about.
Particularly in the face of a Command and Conquer, right? Because then it is like actually up a card in that scenario. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's exactly the thing I was thinking of. It's like, I get it. I do get it. But it just manifests in such an over-the-top way in Zen. And that's where a lot of the squeeze is coming from, for my money. But I'm still open to the idea that like maybe it's something we have to put a tighter lid on. And certainly, again, like that's why I point to that number on Traverse being the thing that I'm, you know, again, I wouldn't go as far as being like, this is wrong, this is a failure. But the thing I'm least pleased about, like I wish it defended for one, just because it mitigates a tiny, tiny amount of that. And the card is still really good. Like it just doesn't have to defend for two. That's the thing I come back to over and over. So that is way more where that kind of complaint is rooted in for me, is just like, make the card you need to make. You don't have to go over the top of the card you need to make. And in this case, it's clear we went over the top of it.
Yeah. I think it was PT Lil was the very first time. I think we were playing it was Prism V Viscerai leading up to PT Lil. And I was about to attack with an aura. And I was like, wait a second, you have Crown of Providence. I shouldn't attack with this aura. I should not attack and just arsenal and pass. And then that was like attacking's not always good. So it's been years I've been dealing with this play pattern where like thinking about attacking is like something that is like a real cost at times. So I
that sounds really good to me. Like that sounds like a really positive part of the game system.
I think it's fine. I just think I agree with you that I think it is just the overtuning of Traverse. But I guess the other card that people really don't like then, though, is Striders of Reprisal, right? Where getting that tiger for free and then using that tiger for Art of War is something that people really dislike as well. Is that just more of an issue with Art of War than it is Striders at that point? Or is that just also something that you have to think about, like putting cards into people's hands is just intrinsically like something you have to be careful with?
There's intrinsic risk in putting cards in people's hand. And it was Striders oscillated back and forth between a Mystic Ninja card and a Ninja card up until the last second. And that is, you know, the difference between a Mystic Ninja card and a Ninja card is one puts it in your hand, one puts it in your banish zone, basically. And it was a very, very challenging decision, and ultimately went with the card in hand, knowing all the risk that it entailed. But again, like, feels powerful, feels cool. It is something that is probably a little too easy to do now. And I think in conjunction with Traverse, you either do it twice per game or you just do it massively on one turn where you can overcome any defensive output your opponent may have. So it feels like a cumulative problem rather than a strides problem. Like, if just one of these cards existed and not both, are we having the same discussion? I don't know.
Sure.
I don't know.
And then what would it take for Art of War to be banned? Is that something you can comment on? Because I know that's been a card that the community's been bubbling up and talking more and more. Is that eventually it just seems like a card that is going to be more problematic in the long run for go wide decks than not?
Yeah, I think if we just reach a state where we're like, the game is better without Art of War in it, then Art of War will be banned. Like, it just is something that we are continually thinking about. And, you know, anything that is making Flesh and Blood less appealing to play, less fun, less balanced, it always has a bit of a target on its back. And, you know, if we ever reach that tipping point where we're just like, okay, this is not contributing to a positive experience any longer, it's become net detrimental to the game of Flesh and Blood, it'll go. Like, it just, there's no sacred cows. That's what I will say. And if there is a point where we are convinced that it's time, that's the move we'll make.
I literally just said that in a Discord message like 3 days ago. So I'm very much with you.
It's one of those things, right? Like, I talk about this all the time. Everything we do as TCG players, extrapolation from small sample sizes. Thus far, over the course of Flesh and Blood, obviously we have not banned Art of War. Therefore, it looks like a sacred cow that you could never ban in a million years. And you could say that about all the other cards which have not been banned. And, you know, you make a good case, but is the sample size just too small? Is it that 5 years actually isn't all that long for a game to have been in existence? And, you know, there's still many, many future moves to make. Possibly. That's the case.
All right. Well, we're coming up on an hour here now, and I want to be respectful of your time. Do you have any final questions here, Michael?
I think we got through everything I wanted to ask.
Okay. And then now I'd like to turn it over to you, Brian. Is there anything you want to ask us or our listeners, or just anything you want to address? The floor is yours.
So every time I cover one of your matches, Roger, I feel like it's critical that I tell the audience that you and I are friends and not enemies. Do you think I have overestimated how much people think we are enemies, or is this just a good service that I should go ahead and continue to put out there every single time?
Well, I'm not going to complain if you want to talk me up and say nice things about me without, okay, like that's not a negative to me. That's obviously,
you know, when you made your bluff at Nationals, I was the only one who had your
I was
Roger.
So
everyone
mad.
Else I was everyone else is like, absolutely, he forgot it was an Arsenal. I was the only one who was like, I think Roger's capable of this play.
Yeah, like, I wish we were mic'd, because I legitimately said, oh yeah, you have that, I have this, we're fine. I thought that might have been too much, but it wound up working. But that's neither here nor there. I did not forget. So yes, thank you very much for crediting me for that. Okay, I think it's because, I think since you and I are so much of birds of a feather, that the social media relationship between you and I got tense for a little while, where it was hard to see through the hyperbole or the dry.
That's every relationship. Like, I can't tell you how many people who like I'm confrontational with on Twitter, and then we see each other in person, if we're just all good, like completely fine. And then I can't tell you how many people there are who are out there in the world and they're convinced they hate me. Like, they're just so sure I'm the worst person on the planet. And I'm sure if we just like got in the same room as each other, we would have a great time together. So it is the nature of those platforms. I think that is always what comes of social media. And that's why I do feel the need to clarify, because like, we have gotten into it before, but like, I think always in a respectful way where like, we come out understanding each other's positions. And of course, we've had plenty, plenty more discussions beyond that, not in the public space. And that's another thing I think people often miss too, is like, you see this small bit of context, right? This small bit of our relationship. You don't see all the other conversations we've had. So I think, you know, I just know how tone can be interpreted sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I like to just go ahead and clear the air and make sure everyone knows where our relationship stands.
Yeah. We're unified as the other guys. Like no one can ever take that away from us. So.
Absolutely right. And then with Michael, I feel like now I've developed this thing where every time I interview him, I just antagonize him for some reason. And I don't know why I do this.
Yeah, but I don't know where you would ever get that from.
Like, he just comes to the booth and I'm like, I'm going to give this guy a hard time today.
That's crazy. I wonder if anybody else in his life has ever given him a hard time.
He's done a very good job getting comfortable with my needling of him in the booth. And so I hope this podcast appearance just gets rid of any doubt whether I'm a pro Manor podcast guy. I am always a big fan of you guys, always happy to come on and chat with you. So
appreciate it, Brian. I'll tell you what, just for you, I'll start needling Michael so he kind of gets used to it more. So the next time you interview him, he'll
you've
be
already
used to the
done
needling.
That.
Nah, keep it up. Just keep doing it.
Okay. Well, with that being said, the next time you're needling Michael Hamilton,